What's up, everybody? Welcome back to World on Drugs. I am your podcast host, Steve Fury. You know me, baby. We know each other. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, this is a podcast that does a deep dive into famous drug dealers and criminals all over the world that you haven't heard of. And I'm not talking about Griselda Blanco. I'm not talking about El Chapo. I'm talking about creeps. Daywood Abraham Koskar, Aseel Guillen. And this week, we got the Mungiki tribe. If you don't know about the Mungiki tribe, they are a cult in Kenya based off of Islam and African folk religions. They started as a way to kind of defend a minority group in Kenya, the Kikuyu. And then they kind of delve into becoming a paramilitary terrorist organization who uses machetes and beheadings to get their points across. Were they a marginalized group that the police were attacking? Yes. Were the police attacking them because they were beheading people with machetes? Yes. So it's great episode. Check it out. This week we got on Jesus Trejo. If you know me at all or you follow my Instagram at all, you know Jesus. He is one of my best friends, you know. Definitely one of my work best friends, you know. I can't tell how much this guy means to me. He's helped me out so much in my career. So we'll just jump into a little bit about Jesus. If you don't know who he is a stand-up comedian. He's a paid regular at the Comedy Store. He was a door guy at the Comedy Store before I was there. He has a stand-up special on Showtime called Stay at Home Son. He has done The Tonight Show twice. He's done James Corden, I believe, twice. And he's been on Comedy Central. And he's got JFL New Faces. He's repped by my same management. First time I met Jesus Trejo was after the first week I went to LA. I got on the Kill Tony show. I crushed. And I went to go do Brian Redband's podcast at the Ice House at the time. So it was a big week for me. You know, I got to do the store, the Ice House. I'm a guy from Sacramento, never had anything. Get to the Ice House. I'm nervous. Everyone's kind of talking over each other. And Jesus is there. He's sitting next to me. And we kind of just hit it off. And we're laughing a bunch. We're having a good time. And I'm like, oh, this guy's pretty fucking cool. I go home. I come back a couple weeks later. I go down to go hang out with a girl I'm dating at that time. I guess she forgot I was coming. And she was on a date with someone else. So I just had to hang out in my car and sleep in my car that night. And that sucked. And so what I did was I went to the Comedy Store. And in the beginning, when you go to the Comedy Store, it is intimidating. It's intimidating if you're a patron because you don't know how to get around because it's a maze. It's intimidating if you're a comedian. Side note on that, one of my favorite things is when comedians complain that it's not welcoming. It's like, bro, it's fucking Harvard, dog. Why would it be welcoming? Nothing's welcoming. Nothing in the world's welcoming that deserves to be welcoming. This isn't fucking Chick-fil-A, dog. This is the best place in the world filled with the best comedians. Needless to say, I was there knowing no one, feeling like a fucking weirdo sitting by myself. Jesus walks by me, and he remembers me. And he didn't have to. He was a paid regular at the time, wasn't a door guy anymore. And we kind of hit it off, start chopping up a little bit. And he goes, hey, I'll get you up on potluck on Monday. This would have been about the third Monday in a month that I was getting up a potluck. Get up on potluck again. I crush. Adam says he loves me. I then start moving down. From then on, Jesus became one of my best buds. He's a blessing to have in my life. I wouldn't have a lot of this stuff in my career. I don't think many people have helped me out in my career. I honestly don't. I think I've kind of busted my ass and got most of the stuff on my own. But I would say Jesus helped me out for sure. From then, I became a door guy. Right before I became a paid regular, it was the day after the Comedy Store Christmas party. And if you know anything about that, gets a little raucous. Goes to about 8 a.m. if you know what I'm talking about. So the next day, I go up, and this woman named Chelsea Skidmore, another comedian, she was a booth girl. I go on stage, and she just starts shitting on me. I don't know why. And then I go on stage, and a little bit funnier than her, just destroy her. Destroy her immensely. Turns out my current manager, Alex, God damn it, cat. Here's the cat. Turns out Alex is in the audience, and he sees me. And I'm all hungover, and he likes me a lot. And he talks to Jesus, who's his client at the time. And Jesus not only co-signs me, he pushes me. And I end up getting signed by Levity, which to me is, it's statistically probably a top two or three company, but to me, it's number one, because people at Three Arts, people at Brillstein, they don't talk to their managers or have the relationship with their managers that people do at Levity. I talk to my manager maybe every day, if not at least three times a week. So from there, I start getting on other shows. My life starts getting better. And we cut to current day, where now Jesus... I went to Jesus' special. I watched his special. He's done all my shows. He's, honest to God, one of my best friends. And now he's on his way to blowing up. And I'm opening for him all across the country. And it's a blessing to work with someone that's one of your best friends, someone who you look up to. And... someone who's really fucking cool, man. And no one has anything bad to say about the guy. He grinds his ass off. And I think that's why we get along, because he respects the hustle and being funny. And that's something both, I think we both have. So needless to say, this was a treat to have him on. This one's very fact heavy. And I don't know. I think it's pretty good, honestly. It is one of the Robin ones. So if you're a fan of his, he's come back to do this one. It's pretty good. I enjoyed it. We recorded it in Tempe. If you want to know more about Jesus, man, you can check out his clips on YouTube or follow him on Instagram. I believe it's Jesus Trejo. Maybe comedy in there. You'll find it. He's the biggest Jesus Trejo. So last week, I was in Tempe, Arizona with Jesus, and my girlfriend went out there. You know, man, how do I feel about Arizona? I feel I really like the people. Arizona, Phoenix, Tempe, I mean, it's all the same fucking place. I don't know. They want to pretend it's not. It's the same place. You're too close. You're too close, Phoenix, Arizona area, to be pretend you're different people. It's like people living in the same room and thinking that they're not brothers and sisters or something, you know? It's like, no, you're together. You're the same thing. Tempe, Scottsdale, whatever. Little different cultures, but I really fuck with Phoenix, man. The crowds are lit. People are good. Politics, a little wonky. Not my favorite thing in the world. But, you know, they make it up. You know, sometimes, you know, really just goes to show how you might not agree with people's politics. And that's probably why you shouldn't bring them up. Because the people themselves might be cool as fuck. And they are cool as fuck. And they were great to me. And I know there's a few new listeners from there. So, thank you guys. I'll always be back. That is going to be a city that I will play the rest of my life. And every time I do it, I am excited to do it. So... good to see you guys. Thanks for jumping on board the podcast. We're seeing the numbers raise. It's pretty cool to watch this thing that I've been dumping a lot of time and money into get better. Oh, look at all the cat hair all over my face. Get better, man. And people are enjoying it and they're respecting it and it's getting better. We're up to like a couple hundred downloads an episode. So thank you guys. Thanks to all the new people. I'm going to keep pumping these out. Keep trying to get better and better. You know, guys, I would say comment on my clips on Instagram, you know, tell me, start talking to me about if what episodes you liked, what things you did like, what things you didn't. If you want to just DM me, feel free. I'm here for constructive criticism. I'm not necessarily going to listen to you. But if enough people say the same shit, I will listen to it. You know, maybe if there's different formats we're enjoying. But other than that, we're doing pretty good. How was last week? Phoenix was great, man. Couldn't enjoy that more. I had my last JF, hopefully, ugh, good, don't want to jinx that, hopefully my last JFL audition. If you don't know what JFL is, Just for Laughs, it's the biggest comedy festival in the world. It is where all the comedians that you enjoy have gotten discovered. Almost every comedian that's big now has gotten this. It's like a doctorate or, I mean, to be honest, being passed at the Comedy Store is way cooler and harder to do. But this is something I always wanted. I have done it for, this is my fourth year. I've done pretty good every year, but I did kind of my old style, which is if you've seen me, you kind of see my set right now is splitting up between stories and set of punchline jokes, bang, bang, bang. So the last 3 years I did this, I've always done pretty good because set of punchline stuff normally hits, bow, bow, observations, but that's not what these people want. So if you are a comedian listening to this, and you're thinking about your JFL set one day, they care about your story. That's all they care about. Make your story funny. Show who you are. Oh, but that's not the funniest thing in the world. Yeah, but it's not about being funny, guys. That's what I learned. You know what it's about? Packaging yourself so you can sell it to a network so you can get a fucking TV show. That's what it's about. If you want to learn more about JFL and what that is, there is a great documentary about the 2018 JFL called Inside Jokes on Amazon Prime. It is free. It is 3 or 4 episodes. I never really wanted to watch it because there's a bunch of people getting something I think I'm better than. True, but, you know, every comedian probably feels that way. So I didn't watch them, but after this audition, I decided to watch them with my girlfriend so she could understand the importance of this. She's been supporting me very well. What happened at the audition, Steve? So normally I've been having my auditions. We're always at MI Westside in Santa Monica. Great club. It is an improv club, and I've been known to bomb there a few times, but I've always done pretty good there. This one was at Dynasty Typewriter. It's like fantastic, you know. Let's keep going to venues that aren't built for stand-up. If you don't know what Dynasty Typewriter is, it is an old-school movie theater, I believe. Really cool setup. Beautiful place. It's all, like, smoky inside. The lights look good. The aesthetics are on point. That being said, they don't serve alcohol. So, you know how I feel about that. I don't like to do stand-up without a beer before or two. Don't like to be drunk, but, you know, 2 or 3 beers, man, I'm just loose. I'm feeling good. They didn't have that. So, brought a couple of Rhodes sodas for the Care Bear. Pounded those in the parking lot. Went to the show. Luckily, it was with some of my good friends, man. You know, it's really funny to see how far I've come in comedy now. Comedy in L.A. Where when I was first getting these things, I didn't know anybody. I felt weird, awkward. I didn't belong. I've been here long enough now where they're pretty much all my friends. We had Ricardo Flanagan, very funny guy, L.A. guy. We had Mitch Burrows, one of my besties, just had a baby, ex-door guy, married a waitress, which is kind of blasphemous, but whatever. And then I also had Chase Bernstein. If you don't know who Chase Bernstein is, oh, she's one of my favorite comics, really is. You know, she's got such a different point of view and different voice. It's really funny stuff. So I go up fourth, which is pretty good. You know, I don't know if they make the lineup in a way that they want to favor people. Because I've always gone last. And, you know, if you've seen me, I'm kind of dirty. So, or not even, I am kind of dirty. But I'm definitely, you don't want to put me up first. You know what I mean? I'm not a first comic. I shouldn't be opening shows. I mean, I can with my new story bit. Oh, I got to remember that too, the story bit about that. Because I stopped talking about that when I said the punching up stuff. Or the, not punching up, but the shorter jokes. So, I got fourth. Pretty good fucking place in the lineup. Room's already open. You can be dirty. You can be clean. You can do whatever you want in that spot. I normally had to go last every time, but I was always dirty and always hit him with energy and always hit him with punchlines. So, I always did pretty good. This year, I went, fuck it. I'm going to do my story. If you haven't seen the recent story, it is a story about my dad getting married 3 times and then me wearing a ridiculous outfit that my mom made me in 5th grade. You get a 6-minute set on JFL. This story was 6 minutes. So if this bitch doesn't hit in the beginning, I'm bombing my dick off for 6 minutes. Luckily, if you've seen this show or you've seen this story, shit doesn't bomb, dog. It is might be the best bit I've ever written. If you want to see kind of a first rendition, go to the Comedy Store's website or their Instagram. And it's probably like the 25th pick down. It's a picture of me. It's about a 6-minute bit. I go there. I do the story. I might be a little biased. I think I had the best set. I mean, that's what everyone told me. I do. I could do good. But, you know, being me, man, I've had a lot of shit go in my life not come through. Especially, you know, when I was dealing drugs when I was a kid. You can't focus on things that you hope will come true because they might come true. You can't rely on them. So I go into a lot of things thinking, I'm not going to get this. I mean, I visualize that I'm going to get it, but I put in my head that I'm not going to get it. That way, if I don't get it, it's like, well, this is what I planned for. So, Wednesday, I got my story. I'm going to do the story. My doctor calls me. I'm not going to talk too much about this, but gave me a really gnarly health scare I'm kind of worried about still. So, that fucked me up. I'm like, oh, God, now I'm doing this story, and I got this health scare. I don't know what's happening. It's making me think of a lot of weird shit. So, I head to the show, whipping the new Lex. Love that car. Makes me very happy. Get there. Smash the car bar. The road set is in the car bar. Do my spot. I do good. I'm feeling okay, man. I'm like Luckily, my buddy Pete Lee, if you don't know Pete Lee, he's done The Tonight Show more than any other current comic right now. Hilarious guy. Sweet boy. I helped him paint his trailer mansion. He has a trailer on the coast or the cliffs of Malibu that overlooks the ocean. It's one of the most badass fucking things I've ever seen. Love his girlfriend, Jamie. He's hosting. I get to talk to him. It's just fun, you know. In the beginning, when you do these things, you don't know nobody. But now I know people. They're my friends. So I'm doing shit with my friends. And I haven't seen people in a long time. Show was a little weird because the guy named Jeff Singer, he's the guy who books JFL. He's been doing it for 25, 30 years. He has seen every comedian that matters for the last 30 years. He's the guy who chooses people. He's the guy who makes the decision if you get your big break shot, your big shot. You can do it without it, but it really helps. So normally he's a French-Canadian guy. He always wears fedoras. He's in on the joke. He has like 100 fedoras. He sits in the corner. He never laughs. You watch your set. He doesn't really talk to you. He's kind of sullen because normally the guy's watching. He's doing this all year, watching 10, 15 people a night all year and debating with his other co-producers of this thing who should get in this festival. But he hasn't been doing that because of the pandemic. So the guy comes in to the green room and he's the nicest guy I've ever met. Saying hi to me, saying all this cool shit, saying hi to everybody, introducing people, brings up the show. He's just stoked. I go up, and I fucking do really well, man. I wouldn't say it's the hardest I've ever crushed these JFL auditions, because, you know, the dirtier jokes and the bang, 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 punchline, punchline, punchline. I can get them rolling to where people are, like, wheezing, but the story is very insightful of who I am as a person. It ends on a huge laugh. It's what they want. I do great. I come off stage. My manager, Alex, is there. He texts me. He came. He always comes everything important. That's why I would say if you can get booked, if you can get anywhere, man, if you're thinking about going to any management company and you have a chance to get to Levity, because they do keep it small there, man. They're not like Three Arts where each guy's like 45 comedians under his belt. These guys have a handful. So if you got a chance, man, I couldn't suggest anything more. He comes. He brings a couple agents. Show ends. I walk out front. I go to talk to him. Agents are cool to me. Alex is cool to me. They all say I was great. They all say I had the best set. Also, man, this is another one. Hang out after you do your spot, especially if it's important, because the booker of the show, the booker of the festival, other comedians, other bookers that might be there, they might want to talk to you after the show. This is a job. Do not leave early. You're not some movie star. Put in the fucking work. Man, I'm getting a lot of wrinkles. So I'm out there hanging out. Bunch of other comedians out there. I'm talking to my manager, talking to these two agents. Jeff comes out and he's looking at me. And I've done this 4 years. This motherfucker has never talked to me once. He might have said, hi, Steven, but he wasn't warm before to anyone I ever seen. Dude beelines to me in front of all the agents and my manager and just starts giving me the nicest compliments I've ever heard anyone give me, especially from someone that you pray to God will give you these fucking compliments. The guy was telling me how much of a pro I am, how special, how my act was perfect. And also what's cool about this Jeff Singer guy is he remembers every one of your jokes. I don't know if it's like a mild autism thing, but he goes up and he's like, oh, you did a whole new set. That was amazing. You're so strong. All this shit. And he's doing it in front of the agents and my manager. And I'm just staring at him. And then as he's talking to me, he kind of stops and goes, why are you not saying anything? And I'm like, dude, I've done this for 4 years and you've never said a word to me. So I'm a little bit weirded out. He starts laughing. And then he cuts the conversation with my manager, Alex, and the agents. He goes, hey, Steve, can I bring you over here and to give you more compliments? What? Yeah, bro, you can do that. I'll fucking burn these people. I will kill my manager in a fire for you to do this. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't do that. So then he brings me over again and just starts laying in these compliments. So my day went from being nervous about this JFL thing. It was straight to callbacks too. So watch the documentary, man. If you got time, the episodes are pretty short. It's done pretty well. Not all those guys make it. I know all those comics. And you really get to realize what this thing is and how important it is. So he does that. Tells me a bunch of crazy shit. Doesn't say I'm going to get it, but to me, seemed like he said everything before,
hey, you're going to get it.
So after that, then I go hang out with my manager and Rachel Hall, one of the agents. Excuse me, I'm not even drinking. I got burps. And then the night goes well, man. I stop worrying about the health scare, and then I just, that happens. Then I go to Tempe, and shit gets popping. So it was a pretty good week, man. And, you know, Tempe, it was good because of all the fans, you guys out there. So thank you, new Tempe people. You guys made it great. All right, let's go some of the stuff I think you should check out. Mayor of Easttown, whatever the fuck it is, on HBO Max. First two episodes are a little wonky, a little boring, but the shit gets popping. I would highly suggest watching that. Music-wise, J. Cole just came out with a new album last Friday. Very good. Definitely not the most melodic of his things, but definitely bar for bar, he is fucking spitting. So that one I really enjoyed. Also, there's a song called, it's by this guy named Bat Boy Blackie. I'd never heard of him before. I've never heard of Bat Boy Banky. His best song right now is Wake 'Em Up. Check that out. He has not been discovered yet. He's got about 16,000 monthly listeners, but this Wake 'Em Up song, shit slaps, dog. It really slaps. It really takes a turn in the middle. Listen to the whole thing. And it's really fun. You know, it's one of those songs that I feel like Kanye West and Travis Scott kind of like were on the forefront of, where you listen to half the song and it's one song and the beat completely changes. So that one I've been banging nonstop. TV show East of Mayor of Easton. That's it, guys. I can feel some good vibes. They come from you fans, you guys listening to this, my parents, my friends, my families. I feel some heat coming. Oh, last week I also got a open the OR at the Comedy Store, which is kind of what, the day before the JFL edition, I got to open it, and which is kind of why I was like, I don't have opener energy. I mean, the story hit, but you know, I'm talking about condoms and doing drugs and shit like that. It's not really, you don't want to open, you don't want to eat, you know, it's like a shot of fucking tequila with no chaser, my act. It's better when you're a little drunk. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's pretty good. My act is like a shot of tequila. Right off the gate when you wake up, not pretty good. But about 11:30 at night, might be one of the best drinks you ever had. So my set was okay. The new booker, Emily, was there. I want to say this about Emily LaFour, the new booker. If you look at these lineups, guys. This woman knows what she's doing. She's giving people chances, young people chances. Her lineups are just as good as Adam's were. And I'm proud to have called her my friend. You know, I was friends with her when I was a door guy, and she was just an assistant to the fucking belly room. And now she's maybe the most one of the most important bookers in the world. And she knows what she's doing, and people fucking doubted her, and they should have never doubted her, because she's done this a long time, and she's smart, and I'm so happy for her, and I'm happy she's, you know, she's watching my sets. Did I have the best set? No. But it just feels good that someone's watching you and cares about the fucking job. Not the last guy didn't. He was great too. I mean, he passed me. I couldn't ask for more. But I think I'm going to like Emily a little more. But I kind of didn't do great. So then I was a little worried about my JFL audition the next day. But if you're a stand-up comedian and if you're just starting, I welcome bombs. I welcome bombing. Why? Because when you get to the point where I'm at, which I think I'm pretty good and I very don't often bomb, when I just keep crushing, I don't think I'm going to crush my next set. I think someone's got to pay the piper soon. You know, there's always just one that doesn't go well. So luckily, my set at the Comedy Store, I mean, I don't really bomb because I'm pretty good, but I didn't go that well. So to me, it was a bomb. So I got the bomb out of the way, got the restarted the juju clock, and it all worked out on JFL. Next week, we got a Dr. Joe Hoffswell's double part banger, folks. Ooh. I'm doing the 18th Street Gang. You heard me? Yeah, that one's going to be pretty fun, man. We decided to do with Dr. Joe was take his stuff, spread it out. He's going to do once a month. I'm going to get a couple other people to do the shorter ones. He's going to do double parters, once a month. It'll allow me to start getting ahead of podcasts. And this one's 18th Street Gang. We go into different factions, how they started. This is a local LA gang. So I could get shot, to be honest with you, but it's worth it. So once again, guys, this is the Mungiki tribe, cult kind of. Fucked with religion. So, a minority trying to save themselves from discrimination and attacks from other people that spun out of control and just real psycho shit. So it's a really good episode. Once again, shout out to Robin Fitch McCullough, the researcher. He does a good job. Happy to have him on board. He's making I got two from him, some two good ones coming up. A little short though. I'm not sure what I'm gonna do about those. Might start doing a Patreon. You know, these numbers are getting to the couple hundreds that maybe a couple people want an extra two episodes a month. And I'm also getting some merch made. It's going to be the World of Drugs logo with my name on it on a black t-shirt on the front. Start selling them at shows. So if you guys want one of those, keep an eye out. Be fun to support me. $25 probably a piece. 40 for two. I don't know why you'd want two, but maybe you do. So guys, thank you very much. I love you. Thanks for hanging out on the podcast. Thanks for making this thing a little community. Please DM me what you do, what you don't like. Let's get this thing better. Let's whittle it down. We're still only 13, 14 episodes in, and it's finally getting some heat. I feel some heat. Thank you, guys. Once again, this is Jesus Trejo and the Mungiki Kenyan Tribe cult. See you guys soon, buddy.
Jesus Trejo, good to see you, buddy.
What's up, man? Good to see you. We here in Tempe, Arizona, baby.
It was hard to get you, you know?
Oh, what? Come on, man. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for letting me come on. This is exciting stuff, dude.
Yeah, we've been having a good time in Tempe the whole time.
Yeah, man, you've been crushing the shows, man. Just, complete, like, slaughter. You're making me work up there. Well, I'm having a great time.
I'm only crushing because you're selling them out. We're getting 500 people on a fucking Thursday.
It's been fun, man. It's been cool. It's not as hot as I thought it was going to be.
Already. Yes. I mean, it was hot as fuck Thursday, and I was like, this is going to be a rough time. But now it's 80 with like a light breeze.
Yeah.
It's making me be like, oh, this place isn't that bad. And then like 3 days from now, it's 400 degrees. So we're going to do this one's pretty great. This we got with one of my best researchers, Robin. He's an ex-military guy. He does really in-depth stuff, and this one's pretty cool. So this is all about the Mungiki. It is a... Well, you know, like a lot of things, started with white people ruining something, and then from there they grew into an organization. They were a quick synopsis. They white people, you know, the apartheid stuff and took over their country. And then when they left, it was a one party system. These guys tried to go back to their home roots and find their culture after 120 years of occupation. And then through a mix of African tribal religions and Islam, they slowly lose their fucking minds and go into cannibalism, go into human sacrifices.
Oh, man.
And their favorite means of attacking people is machete. Ooh. So the roaming groups of guys that are machetes.
That's brutal.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty brutal. We don't get too brutal. I mean, once we get into the cases at the end, you see a little bit more. We could have gone a little more gory. But also, though, you know... They also get so bad because it's like a weird religion that people are oppressing. So then we'll just get into it. We'll start it right here.
Okay.
Straight to the timeline, the background to the cults and organized crime in Kenya. 1840s, European missionaries begin to explore and proselytize what is now Kenya. The region is ostensibly under control of the Arab and Muslim Sultanate of Zanzibar. In reality, the Kikuyu and other tribes are independent.
I have to say, you're pronouncing those words like great. I would have a hard time.
I mean, honestly, some of the English words in this one, the proselytize, got me more than I've luckily written a lot of this and read it all. And
that's good. If I had to read this, it would be a long episode. Proselytize.
Yeah, that one. Some of my research, I think Robin snuck in a few words in here. I'm like, I've never even heard this in English.
I think he's trying to fuck with you.
Yeah, he knows I'm trying to read this. He knows I got a couple beers in me. So then they go to 1871. So about 30 years from there, the French Empire is defeated by an alliance of German states. Desperate German states unite into the German Empire. Both France and Germany advocate for new colonial ventures in Africa. Has anyone heard about slavery coming there? That's probably actually was already there at that time, but that's kind of what happens there. In about 1882, a nationalist revolution threatens to close the Suez Canal in to European trade. Great Britain intervenes and occupies the country. France, Belgium, Germany, and other European countries rapidly step up their own colonial enterprises. Mm. Got a feeling this isn't going to end well. Just a little guess. 1885, the Berlin Conference regulates trade, exploration, and military ventures in Africa. The entire continent is effectively divided amongst European powers, which is nice because it's Africa, not Europe. The region of modern Kenya is allotted to the British East African Association.
Wow.
How fucked is that, man? Someone just comes into your house and starts dividing it amongst your neighbors.
It's like, no, the whole thing is my house. And then they're telling you what wing of the house you own. Like, no.
Not even. You don't even get it. Oh, they're like, no. It's not your house. It's actually your neighbor's houses. You're going to live here or we're going to move you somewhere and it's going to be a lot worse.
That's so terrible.
Here's a question. Has anything ever started well with the words European powers?
No. Maybe European soccer.
Yeah, oh, there you go, yeah. The European power. But now they're trying to get that Super League, which could be...
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. I'm not a soccer guy, but I heard about that. It's like, that. That's not good.
Essentially, what they're doing there is they're going to take all the biggest teams and put them in one league. But the reason that the other teams help and the smaller leagues help out is because they share the revenue with the poor teams. So people that are in, like, you know, the Oakland A's of the Premier League still get to have money and fans because the big guys get the contracts. But if they do that, then everyone's going to die and there's only going to be, like, 30... teams.
Not cool, bro. So yeah, even in that example, not good.
Yeah, maybe like a sausage factory. Like, you know, like once a year all the European powers come together for a bratwurst battle.
Oh man. What about European cars? Are you a fan of European cars?
That's cool. Yeah, but they just always break down.
They do. They oil leak like hell.
Yeah, something goes wrong and it's super expensive. Like my whole thing, I was searching for a car for like 6 months. I just got a car, a Lexus. And my thing,
nice.
Yeah, pretty. It's old, but it's
why,
got.
Why'd you say Lexus like under your breath? You got to say Lexus.
I know. I just feel embarrassed.
I got a new car,
Lexus.
And no, dude, you work hard.
Yeah, I did work hard. It is everything I ever wanted. But when the people, it's weird. That, like now, I wash it every day. And like my old car, I had this old Corolla that had like dandruff as its paint job.
I will say this is like when you ask for something, be very specific, because as a kid I always wanted a foreign car. Like I'm gonna push foreign cars. I do drive a Toyota Yaris, you know. So it's like I gotta be very specific. I should have been like Bentley or, you know.
It's like that one movie Bedazzled. You ever seen that one with Brendan Fraser where he meets Elizabeth Hurley and she is, I think that's the movie, and she's the devil, and he asks for like, he's like, I wish I was a basketball player, and then he's like, it's the cut to the game and he's dunking on everybody, and then he has the interview after, and he takes off his pants. He's got like a tiny baby penis.
Oh no!
And then he has to just keep doing that.
Be specific. If nothing else from this podcast, be very specific in your wishes.
If you meet a genie, know he's gonna try and trick you. 1888, the British East Africa Company is formed to administer parts of East Africa. 1902, much of the verdant highlands of Kenya are allocated to white settlers and their allies. Jesus Christ. Disposed of their grazing land, the Kikuyu move into British-controlled estates or into the cities. That's not good.
So they just start moving through the cities. They're taking over everything.
Well, no, what they're doing... So what happened is the British people are stealing the farmlands, and then they're pushing the native people, the Kikuyu, into cities to create slums. I don't know if they know it's going to actively create slums, but it's going to create slums.
So their motivation to take over like the fields and stuff because it generates money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
For farming and then I guess later for diamonds and gold and shit like that. Mm. So they're pretty much creating a huge slum that's going to be a problem for the rest of Africa's history up until this date. 1905, the capital is moved from Mombasa to Nairobi. 1920, British East Africa is made a crown colony. Administration passes from corporate hands to that of the British government. 1944, Kenya Africa Study Union is formed. They advocate for Kenyan independence from Great Britain. That's nice. That was in 1944.
Nice.
There's actually a couple things that these guys, Africa kind of does with these large studies that really change the way their government happens. We'll see later and all this other stuff. So it's kind of interesting. I feel like Americans, if there's a study, if it just doesn't go with what you want, you're like, no, that's a fake study. You know, whereas
so the study they kind of looked at historically what they were doing, and then if it doesn't work they reassess.
Yeah,
they flight correct essentially.
And they're going to try to do that in the 40s. It's still got a little while. 1952 to 1960, the Mau Mau revolt occurs. A nationalist government guerrilla movement attacks British interests in Kenya. Though they are militarily defeated, Britain grants many concessions to both the Mau Mau and the wider Kikuyu ethnic group and nationalist movements. So this is the one where they fought back, but they like fought back kind of like, from what I read, you know, I do a decent amount of studying in this. It was kind of like tribal guys fighting British soldiers with guns. So like guys were attacking with cowhide.
So it's already an uneven advantage there.
But these guys knew they were going to lose, but they had to fight for the land and what was happening that they kind of just like.
There's something really cool about that, right? It's like, even though you know you're going to lose a fight, it's like you got to stand up for yourself. You're like, I'm going to go out there. It's like, I don't know if you've ever been in that situation, but sometimes where you knuckle up, I am the guy who knows how to fight the least amount ever. But it's like, sometimes it's like, all I need to do is ball up my fist and just throw hands, you know? And if I don't land anything, that's okay. But I need to step up right now.
Yeah, because, I mean, like they always say, when you step up, it teaches people to stop stepping down on you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for them, it could have been so bad that they're like, I would rather die than lose. And also, you know, someone comes in, they take over your land. They take over your culture. They take over your...
You got to do something. Yeah. It's like the last straw. It's like you have to do something. And yeah, kudos to them. I mean, that's like great pride in themselves for sure.
So about 3 years later, in 1963, Kenya is granted independence from the British Empire. The Kenyan African National Union, represent the Kiyuku tribe, forms the ruling government.
So that's the main one, huh?
That's the main one. So this is the problem, though, which we're going to talk about in the next one. 1964, Kenya becomes a republic, leaving the British Empire. The Kenyan African National Union dominates the government, effectively making Kenya a one-party state.
Ooh.
Exactly. Never good.
That's never good. It's like, even when I went to college, like they would talk about, like, I went to school for business, and all the case studies were like when there is no, like, when there's no, like, options or no options in like monopolies are bad. That's goes without saying, but just to have the option of having another choice, like that's important in both business and politics. It's like to be fed only one thing. It's like with absolute power, absolute power comes absolute responsibility
or something like that.
Or was corruption.
That the Spider-Man one? Oh, corruption. Probably corruption more.
Yeah.
Also, like,
there's no one there to check you.
Yeah, there's no one to check you. So it's just like, oh, you don't like this? Well, this is what you're getting because there's nothing else you can do about it.
There's like a Spanish saying that says the mouth is what dictates. It's like when in that position, it's like whatever the powers to be say is like that's what goes and you can't argue it.
So this is so Britain essentially went to another country, stole their shit, destabilized their government and end infrastructure and left them high and dry for a one party government. So for 120 years, they fucked their shit up and then left them. I feel like that's kind of like, you know, when you're in a bad relationship or like when a kid gets emancipated from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's good that you got out of there, or definitely the kids, because your parents were psychos. But now you've had no training. You've been probably put in slums and have no idea. So more often than not, might not work out.
Yeah, you're
great.
Not equipped to kind of hit the real world or you're not prepared because you've been deprived of XYZ.
Yeah, and I don't know this for sure, but I don't think in the 1940s the British people were putting a lot of Kenyans into government so that they can learn from them.
Right.
So from the 1960s to the 1980s, Kenya experiences a major population boom, leading to intense urban crowding, unemployment, and conflict over land rights. So we're going to go to another timeline here, and then we're going to go into the overview.
Okay.
Timeline, 1980s to early 1990s, the Mungiki organization emerges amongst the Kikuyu people of Kenya, beginning as a loose organization advocating for the return to what they perceived as traditional Kikuyu and Bantu values. They soon come into conflict with other ethnic groups, chiefly the Maasai and the Kalenjin. So my pronouncing might not be perfect, but I did look these up. So I'm trying. And
better pronunciation than I would have done.
Yeah, especially when they're back to back. It's like I can kind of get it. But so in the mid 90s, patterning itself off the Mau Mau rebels, the Mungiki leaders move their operations to the slums of Nairobi. They organize themselves in militarily into cells and platoons and take over the Nairobi taxi industry.
Okay.
So essentially.
So what does that mean?
So these guys go into the slums. I mean, a lot of times when you want to get a huge revolution, you go and get the poorest people because there's normally more of them. They're normally more disenfranchised.
Right.
Rich people don't want to change the status quo.
Right. It almost reminds me of like the Pol Pot, like in Cambodia, where they go after the intellectuals and anyone that, you know, what's crazy. I even read this before where it's like they went after anyone who would wear glasses because it was a sign of
intelligence.
Intelligence, you know. So it's like when you get rid of the free thinkers, now you have the people here at the bottom who's like you can. One can argue you can easily influence because they know no better.
Yeah, and they're the guys that you're promising things, and they're like, I want to get better. A funny thing about Pol Pot, what really fucked him up was that since he got rid of all the teachers and all the smart people and anything like that, he hated sparrows a lot.
Really?
Yeah, he hated sparrows a lot, and everyone's a farmer, so he goes like, if you see a sparrow, kill a sparrow. But the problem is the sparrow eats the fucking bugs that eat the plants.
So there was an infestation and the crop went to...
And everyone... That's when everyone started dying.
And people needed to flee the land.
Because, yeah, people needed to flee. People needed to eat. And he had no food for anybody, even though he was the guy who was championing the fucking farmers.
Right.
And it's just like, that's why you got to have a little intelligence. Smart people are not the enemy.
The people you killed off would have told you to leave the sparrows alone.
Yeah. Who ever hated a sparrow, too? Such a weird thing to do. I'd be like, spiders, for sure. Let's get rid of them. Bees, maybe. So the taxi thing is also, so actually what they do a little bit later, which is even, I'll even bring it up now. So they take over taxis and then they take over bathrooms. So most people's, this, you know, this is like the slums of fucking Africa. This isn't like
a barrio. That's rough.
This is like, people don't have bathrooms in their houses. So they have a guy with like a machine gun or machete sitting outside the bathroom. Every time someone has to go poop, they got to pay this guy. And now anytime you want to go somewhere, you got to pay this guy in the taxi because not everyone has cars there. So they start taking over everything.
I love how you said barrios because I'm like, I get that.
Yeah.
No, I get that. But imagine... Imagine that brainstorming session that leads up to this decision. You're like, what do people do the most? Everyone, no matter where you are in the hierarchy of a nation, a family, of the land, you have to go to the restroom. So once you start controlling that, it's like, that's terrible.
I mean, it's kind of what, like, not going to sound too crazy here, what Nestle's doing in America. They're buying up all of our water wells. If you look at all
are
the
they
large...
Really?
Yes. Yeah, they bought like multiples of them. That's why if you really look at why California is going through these droughts, it's because they Nestle bought a lot of the water. And if you look at when they started buying our shit and you look at when the droughts happen, maybe we get less rain than we used to. But there's a large, coalition is not the word, but coincidence between the two of them buying all of our water. And now everything catches on fire.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, because Nestle's fucking evil. But can keep you talking.
Yeah, no. That I've had case studies in college that we did in like my last semester of school, and it was Nestle. You know them trying to do like, I don't remember the full details, but basically they would do like baby formula and they would send it off to third world countries, and there was like a kind of like a thing that went wrong. So it's like, yeah. I didn't know they were evil, but
yeah,
I
evil,
knew they
dog.
Would. They had a lot of errors in their operation that resulted in catastrophic
to
results.
Poor countries and shit. Yeah, I mean, if you think in your head, I want to control the water or bathrooms, that to me is inherently evil. That's like a supervillain. That's how a supervillain thinks. Because if you think medicine and education should be a human right.
Right.
You know what? No one can fucking argue that water and pooping should be the.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, having the whole thing of like, yeah, it's like once you start controlling, you know, people's restroom behavior, like where does it stop? Is it blinking? Is it breathing?
Yeah.
It's like, where does it stop?
What else can be stopped other than the fucking bathroom? But that's going to come up in a second.
Okay.
So quick little overview because, you know, timeline gets a little confusing. We're going to go this one from the 1980s, 1996. Some of the mystery surrounding the Mungiki is tied to their origins, which remain obscured by both the secrecy of the group and the mythology it has created. Originally formed as a self-defense militia for the Kikuyu, the ethnic group that makes up 17% of Kenya's population, they first started engaging. That was a beer burp. Sorry, guys. I drink beer. They've heard me burp a bunch of times on this podcast. They engaged first in cattle rustling and racketeering against their rivals, specifically the Maasai. The Maasai had been selected by the British as one of the martial races that were accepted in colonial Kenya society and had championed ethnic minorities like the Maasai against the large Kikuyu population.
Wow. So let me ask you this. I'm not very bright. So what does martial races mean?
Acceptable.
Oh, really?
So like they were like, you know, I mean, it's Kenya. I'm pretty sure everyone's the same other than, you know, different cultural vibes and stuff. Okay. So they what the British people did is they went to the Maasai and they essentially was like, you know, I mean, this might get me in trouble, but you know how America used to have house slaves and field slaves, and the house slaves were ranked higher than the other ones, so that they could control everything like that. Wow. So that's what they did. So now the Kikuyu are pretty butthurt. I mean, not butthurt. That's a little low to say, but they're mad at these guys.
Yeah.
And these guys think they're better than them. From what I'm reading, I'm not Kenyan, but this is the stuff that I'm read from making this thing and him writing it. So it's also good to see the British come up again, you know, just helping out, like throwing a wrench in the society of these people.
My goodness.
With their origins within the Kikuyu, they chose the Mau Mau as their ideological model. Anti-colonial, anti-imperialist, anti-Western, and extremely African nationalist, the Mau Mau fought the British Empire in Kenya throughout the 1950s. So essentially right here, these are the Mungiki are basing their shit, what they're going to do, off the Mau Mau, which if you really look at it, and you know, these kind of, I mean, that's kind of.
They're being inspired, would you say?
Yeah, they're being inspired by
them. Okay.
But you know, a lot of times when anytime you go too nationalist, that's what happened with like Hitler's people. They're like, yo, stop letting everyone, you know, make Germans seem bad because of World War One. We're good people. We're doing this stuff. And then when you do this shit, it kind of spins out of control. Mm. So like all they were saying is we don't want imperialists here. We don't want Westerners here. And we want to be more African and get back to our culture. And that shit gets pretty rough. Though they were ultimately defeated in a long and brutal war in which both sides were accused of a myriad of atrocities, the Mau Mau became the heroes of the post-colonial era. The Mungiki claimed that they were their heirs and successors of the Mau Mau. And besides protecting their own Kikuyu ethnic traditions and interests, they advocated for a return to tradition for the entire country. Which, you know, a lot of these things to me, if I'm reading this right now, and if I'm a Kenyan, I'm going, I like that. I like that. I want to know my culture that has been taken from me. I want to go get rid of these guys who are pitting me against the Maasai. I want to do all this shit. I want to get rid of British imperialism for the last 120 years.
Would you say that they understand the conflict that's happening against the Maasai? Or is it just kind of like a thing that's like a conflict that's being inflicted on them and they just kind of accepted it? Because what's the time span here? This is like 120 years.
Yeah, 120 years.
Yeah, 120 years. So at some point, it's like the conflict is diluted. It's almost like a family conflict. It's like, why doesn't my mom talk to my aunt? Yeah, we kind of forgot why that is. But
we just don't do it.
Yeah, we just don't talk about it. I don't ask mom and I just don't. Yeah.
And plus, if you know, your aunt thought she was better than you for 120 years because your dad told her that, or her grandpa told her it was, you might have some fucking
beef. It's super deep-rooted.
Like the Mau Mau, to gain support for their endeavors, they moved from the rural farming country of the Kenya into the heavily populated slums of Nairobi. Through the religion and culture they preached became more complex. They advocated their own secret religion that blended folk beliefs with Islam, organized themselves into military cells, and created a litany of oaths and mottos for its members. I need to have one of those cough buttons they have on radio, but beer burps.
Yeah, beer burps. Yeah. You're going to be the... Let it be documented on this podcast that he is like the new version of it. Like there's radio, now there's podcast. There was a cough button, now there's a burp button.
Beer burp button.
Yeah, beer burp button. That's you right here. Steve Fury, ladies and gentlemen.
Revolutionizing podcast game with beer burp buttons. They rapidly began to supplant their cultural activities with criminal ones. Both British imperialism, living in the slums, poor people, military oaths, Islam, and folk beliefs. I don't see how this went wrong. Seems like a recipe for something peaceful and wonderful. That's a little joke I wrote. Sarcasm. The late 1990s. So this is a cool one. A lot of these that we do, we go pretty far back. These guys were butt fucking crazy in the 2000s. But right now, they're just getting steam, you know? It's a nationalist movement. People want to get back to who they were.
Right before the 1990s,
late 90s, the Mungiki move into other industries such as rubbish collection, waste management, and construction. They soon dominate criminal racketeering in Nairobi. Public toilets are occupied and the Mungiki charge for their use.
Oh, man.
You know, it's honestly, and I keep saying this every time I do this podcast, waste management in every company is, in other, every country is normally run by criminals. In America, it was the mafia back in the 90s throughout everything. Mm-hmm. The Yakuza are in Japan. These guys are here. And I think it's because people, like these guys, just how you said, they think, what do people always need? They need a ride, they need to take a shit, and they need to get rid of their trash.
Yeah, because like when I was in college, that was like the big like motif, right? They said it's like, what is the big thing that people look for in business, right? It's a repeat business, something that they could get addicted to, hence Starbucks,
yeah,
right? Starbucks is selling a experience. It's coffee. It's something that everyone is conditioned to think that they need. Mm-hmm. And everyone be like, yeah, I need some caffeine to get me through the day. So it's something that's like a repeat thing. So it's like, even when you look at like somebody like Warren Buffett, is like the business models that he goes after are very unique, right? But in turn, on the other side of that token, is like there's people different than a Warren Buffett that go, what do people need on a daily basis? It's like coffee, it's like gas, it's like,
well, I think that what is, there's a business saying where it's death, sleep, and something else are the three businesses that will never go out of business. So if you have like a funeral home or something like that, that'll always work.
Or the pharmaceutical business. There is no seasons in the pharmaceutical business or in the hospital business. There will always be people that are sick. There will always be people like the school system. There will always be kids in school. You know, they, so there's certain things that are almost like constants in life. You know what I mean?
You know, I just thought of right now, if what? Nestle does buy all the water, they could start charging us for pooping and peeing if our toilets are based, still water-based.
Well, I mean, coffee makes you go number two. So yeah, get both technically of them. They're already ahead of it. You know?
If they buy Keurig, we're fucked. All right, timeline again. Now we're going to late 90s to the 2000s. The Mungiki in power. The Mungiki support in late 1990s supports candidates from the Kenyan African National Union Party through street violence and financial support. In exchange, they are given protection by the government as well as financial and logistical support. Mm. 2002, Mungiki street violence against rival taxi drivers kills 50 in the lead up to the 2002 elections.
Oh, man.
You can't shit. You can't get out. You can't get out of your little area because of taxes. Also, imagine like taxi drivers being gangsters. That would fucking suck. I mean, they are kind of, like, back in the day, taxi drivers were kind of gangsters. They're kind of assholes. They had all the power. Right.
But even, like, think of the whole rideshare thing as we know it now. That's still scary.
Yeah.
Now, imagine back then where there was no glimpse of regulation.
Or, like, you get in a rideshare and the guy in the front seat just has his machete. You're like, I guess I got to keep on this mask.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough.
Also, taxi drivers being gangsters, you're just chilling. You see a checkered cab roll through, and everyone ducks like Ricky from Boys in the Hood.
People must have had big calves back then. It's like, I'll walk. It's like, I'm not taking a taxi. The taxi keeps passing me by. I keep flagging it down. No, that's for your benefit.
Yeah, he's helping you
out.
That's
a blessing in disguise.
December 27th, 2003, the Kenyan African National Union is defeated in the first free elections held since 1963. The winners, the Rainbow Coalition, bans the Mungiki. I feel like if that name, the Rainbow Coalition, too, is like, you know when you're hiding something really dirty? Like, it's like the America's Free Speech Coalition, and it's actually like, you know, the internet trying to censor you and shit.
Oh, I see what you're saying. They're kind of doing their sugar.
It's too positive. Yeah. So this one, overview, we're already kicking ass right here. The overview, early history and Mungiki rise to power, 1996-2002. The group came to public prominence with the sudden taker of the taxi cab business in Nairobi. Mm. Taxi cabs, or as they're called, matatu, were of key economic and cultural significance in the slums. Throughout 1996, a deliberate campaign was undertaken to control the taxi companies, either by forcing independent owners to pay off the Mungiki, or through violence, in which taxi cab drivers were driven out of Nairobi. By the end of the 90s, such violence had extended into control of municipal waste and public restrooms, in which the Mungiki enforcers charged patrons for their use.
So that leads me to believe that not everyone was on board with, like, not all taxi drivers were on board with this situation. So any good faith taxi drivers that wanted to feed their family, they're like, we got to get out of here. This is not going to be a lucrative business. Like, they must have been robbed left and right, anyone who wasn't a part of the gig.
Yeah, I mean,
man,
just sounds terrible. Here we go. Okay, Jesus, you want to take a hostile takeover of Long Beach.
Okay.
These guys started with toilets. I'm guessing most places didn't have their own toilets. What are you taking over in Long Beach to get a stronghold on the base of Long Beach society? I'll go first so you can think. Me with Sacramento, what's the backbone of Sacramento? Beer. I'm going to every brewery in Sacramento. I'm sitting on the big-ass dudes with flannel, and I'm okay. charging someone every time they order a cider, a double IPA. Papa Fury gets a cut.
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, if I'm going to do a takeover of Long Beach, what am I charging for? I'm going to go with, right now, I would do coffee. There's a yeah. lot of coffee shops on every corner, a lot of boutique roasters and that kind of thing. Yeah, coffee is big business. You know, going back to what I said earlier on Starbucks, but, you know, when you have mom and pop, you know, roasters, you know, people take pride in the locally sourced mm-hmm. and roasted, you know, mom and pop business. So it's like, yeah, coffee is a big business. I think
especially
I would do
Long
that.
Beach, I feel like they have a very, whatever the word, nationalist idea for Long Beach would be. It's like they want to support their own and do their
yeah because it's part of a big metropolitan area, so it's like it's part of technically LA County, but it's its own thing.
100% its own thing.
And Long Beach is basically a scaled down version. Like, to scale, it's a like, you know, one third of what LA County would be. So it's like they're kind of doing their own thing. It's like we're part of LA but not really, we're our own thing. So yeah, coffee, food, probably. Yeah, it's like
I like that, too. Like, maybe, like, you sit out front of them and you charge someone like they're going into the club. It's like a $5 entrance fee to go into the coffee place.
You know what it is? As you're saying that, this comes to me. Like, when you go to a casino in California, they charge you, like, 50 cents a hand, like, for a blackjack table. Do you know this?
No.
Yeah. So if you go to, like, in Southern California, you can't go into a card house because there's, if you notice, if all the local.
Yeah, they're weird little card houses.
Yeah, just card houses. There's uh-huh. no slot machines. And the card tables, you have to go there and you have to pay a 50 cent like thing every hand. So that kind of like bites into your profit margin if you're playing a game of 21, you know, a blackjack.
Especially if I'm doing dollar to $5 hands.
Yeah, you're doing $5 hands, and every time it's 50 cents, it's like there's a tax being placed on it. So I feel like if people were doing the thing with the bathrooms. Like, if I was to charge people to eat, let's just do it on food. Any restaurant, there's like a tax, that would be the equivalent. You just get it on the front end as opposed to, no pun intended, back end.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess the government's doing this with taxes. It's just taxing shit for people, but now they're taxing
bathrooms. I guess you're right, yeah.
The rise of the Mungiki came during the last years of the Kenyan African National Union government. The post-colonial party that had ruled the country since 1963. By controlling local election sites, threatening rivals, and donating heavily to the KANU, the Mungiki had gained status as an untouchable organization outside the law. With protection from within the nationalist government, the Mungiki not only continued to pursue criminal racketeering enterprises, but publicly attacked cultural opponents. In 2000, the Mungiki began to draw attention from wider audiences regionally and globally as they started to attack women as seen as being too Western, as well as Christian organizations and Freemasons. So we're going to go a little bit more into that later and start going through what they do. But
So there's just a lot of turmoil, like, financially, right? It's like the businesses, it's what's really, like, dictating the conflict here, right?
Well, I mean, they're also in the slums of South Africa.
Yeah,
like, that's like a rough place that fit. I mean, you know, they're like, you know, if you don't eat a sandwich, you're like, some kid in Africa would want to eat this. These are the people that they're taking over and running shit over, and then the richer people that they're like, well, we don't really care what you're doing over there.
Years ago, like, I remember reading this book about, like, it was a third world country where like, I forget the exact details, but basically they were talking about the Grameen Bank, mm-hmm. and they were doing micro lending to empower people in third world countries.
Yeah, I heard about that kind of stuff. Yeah, but keep going.
Yeah, the micro lending is like to empower people, and it's like it's such a, you know, opposite side of this token, but it's like you could just see how somebody who has a full understanding could just negatively impact a country, a regional area, and it's just like, this is terrible. So it's like, yeah, it's like the opposite of what the Grameen Bank was doing. Yeah. You know, they're empowering people on micro lending to get like a cell phone that they could use as a business. Hey, you want to call your family? You know, you pay X amount, a fraction of a penny to make a phone call, and they could, you know, somebody could come out of poverty that way.
Yeah, instead of giving them money, they're charging them money.
Yeah.
Though it would not be revealed until later, the early 2000s saw high levels of cooperation between the KANU members and the Mungiki. The loan or theft of 10 military Land Rovers to the Mungiki by armed forces was the highest level of direct coordination on the part of the government. Through the Mungiki were often publicly chided for their excesses. They were seen as a useful political ally, both due to the financial and criminal connections to the Nairobi slums, mm-hmm. as well as their role as a militia in the defense of the country's most populous ethnic group. So that's, I see that a lot of times too. Like a couple weeks ago when we did the Bamboo Union, it's in Taiwan. So what these guys did is they started this gang in Taiwan.
Okay.
Called the Bamboo Union, and it started to get so powerful that one of these kind of like B-level political groups kind of hired them out, and those guys helped them get elected. And then once this political group got in power, they used this gang as somewhat of a paramilitary thing. So then they started using these guys to take hits out on other people and start giving them protections. And I mean, kind of what the U.S. does with really big drug dealers. You know what I mean? They start funneling in cocaine like the CIA did, or they're protecting the highest guys so that they get the guys underneath them.
Really?
Yeah. We do some pretty crazy shit. Timeline. Mungiki as a banned organization. Late 2002. Following the ban of the Mungiki, the police begin to crack down on the Mungiki, relying heavily on the extrajudicial measures. Over the next 5 years, it is estimated that 8,000 people are killed or tortured during police operations against the Mungiki. An additional 4,000 are believed to have gone missing or have been displaced during the purges. So, number one, purge, never a good name.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound healthy. Sounds painful.
So
not good.
So, what happens kind of here is, like, the Mungiki are doing crazy shit. They're also kind of seen as a cult. They're also attacking people. They're also kind of taking control of poor people, but the police now go crazy on these guys, and it kind of leads to the Mungiki attacking the police and the police attacking the Mungiki.
That's always such a bummer, right? It's like people always want to take control of the poor people. It's like they already have nothing.
Yep.
And now you're controlling their existence. It's like that to me always weighs heavy on my heart when you hear of these situations. It's like they have nothing. Like, what can you possibly take from them? It's like they're everything, which is their freedom.
Well, yeah. Well, and they're also easier to... Rich people have money. Burp button. Rich people have money to protect themselves. So these guys don't have money to protect themselves. They're just easy targets. And then rich people don't care about what's happening to poor
money,
people.
But it's like, you know, people with money have the resources to get an education, so they don't even understand what's going on. It's you know, above their heads, and I have a soft spot in my heart for stuff like that when people are not equipped to understand and they were taken advantage of. Like, that sucks.
Yeah, and who knows what kind of propaganda these poor people are getting
right
fed to, where they like
that's
think
a great
these
point
Mungiki like, might be good, or they think the police might be good, but in the end they're just getting fed disinformation.
That's a great point, because it's like people in that situation, they're looking to be fed some kind of information or outlook on things, and when they're fed biased information, like, that's even more like heart sinking.
Yeah, I mean, how would they even know?
That's a great point.
Displaced during purges, isn't that the easiest and nicest way to say mass murdered? It's like, huh? No, I didn't sell anyone drugs. Don't be silly. I did lose some cocaine in Jesus's jacket, and I did find his money in mine though. But I would never sell drugs. Early 2003, the head of the Kenyan military is ordered to investigate and report on missing military equipment. It is revealed that a small group of senior army officers supplied the Mungiki with military equipment and logistics and support, chiefly military vehicles. So These guys are getting help from the past military or the past regime that got kicked out, and they were getting, you know, like fucking ATVs and tanks, not tanks as much as, but like the fucking Humvee, the old Humvees with the machine guns on top.
Oh yeah.
So like
the Halo trucks.
Yeah, yeah, they're getting Halo trucks. Exactly. It's GTA style. Now these guys are getting real mad, the new guys. In February 2003, an effort to curb the Mungiki leads to 2 days of street violence. Two police officers are killed, and more than 70 gang members are arrested, with an unknown number left dead. Oh, also, man, we're going to come back and go into these things a little bit more specific. I should have probably put them after, but it's going to be fine. We'll still get it. In June 2007, in an effort to solidify their position in the face of increased police pressure, the Mungiki embark on a terror campaign against independent business owners and former Mungiki members. Over 100 people are killed with machetes just in June. The violence continues until police and military forces intervene. Jesus, question I got to ask here. Would there be a worse way to die than a fucking machete?
It goes without saying that would be a hard no. Like, that's hard to be just
it's like a shark attack on land.
You're just being chopped away. Just like hard chops. I mean, the hard chops is just not good, man.
Yeah, and it's never like, if you ever use a machete to do yard work, it's never like you cut everything down on one swing. It's like you're like, hack.
You gotta hack. Yeah, you gotta keep hacking at it. Yeah, I know my way around a machete working. You know, mowing lawns with my dad, and we would chop down like when we were clean up trees, mm-hmm, or stuff like that, or like we would have to clean out like this like patch of land or whatever, and yeah, that's tough, and people out there just chopping at people, come on, man.
So in November 2007, Oscar Kingara, founder of the Oscar Legal Aid Foundation, an organization focused on civil rights and police violence, releases an investigative report highlighting anti-Mungiki operations by the police. So this is what I was saying when...
Earlier,
where they're switching now. It went from like these Mungiki are, you know, kind of like psychos, but now the police are switching to where it's like, you know, kind of like...
Would you say the police is in their pocketbooks?
Like, no. The police are fucking with the Mungiki.
Oh, they're fucking with them, so yeah, They're not on their payroll.
No.
Oh,
the guys that the Mungiki used to have in power that were helping them out, those guys are got out. New people come in. I kind of put this as the Mungiki are like Islamic people at Guantanamo Bay. You know? Mm. Like they were put in this area, and then whether or not they might have been doing bad shit and planning to do bad shit, we also like severely fucked them up and did crazy stuff to them. And then this guy's Legal Aid Foundation report is going to show a lot of wild shit that these cops were doing to these guys. December 27, 2007. Mawai Kibaki is reelected in an election widely seen as fraudulent. Protests rapidly devolve into ethnic violence against the Kikuyu. So the Kikuyu are the guys that the Mungiki are protecting and stuff from the Maasai. In January 1st, 2008, election violence reaches its peak after a church filled of Kikuyu are burned alive.
Oh, my God.
Negotiations commence for the forming of a new government. 2007 was a rough fucking year for Kenya. So they go from police dying, 100 gang members dying, protests, 100, what is it, a whole church full of Kikuyu are burned alive.
Ugh, that's a cold way to go. You're talking about if there's the worst way to die than a machete. It's like, how about somebody who has a wholehearted faith and they're doing the right thing, right? You know, I'm all for anyone who pursues a religion for the betterment of themselves. So they go to church, right? That's a good thing to do. You're praying and they burn you there. Yeah.
Because then it's attacking your physical and spiritual beliefs, because it's like you're praying to a guy and you're like, save me and my friends and my family. Ooh. And while you're getting burned alive, I mean, any of this shit, a lot of these things, I feel like if I'm in an organization, you know, maybe I'm a criminal, I don't mind that, being a little dirty, but once you go into the thing of like, either, you know, the white supremacist going into a church and shooting them up, or cartels, yeah, blowing up a church, or these guys, it's like, once you start getting the church thing, how do you justify that?
Yeah, I guess the moral compass is very skewed at that point.
Yeah.
And there is no, essentially, rules,
no,
right?
There's no coming back. You're just a fucking hellscape of a human being.
Lost soul.
All right, we're coming to an end on this one. We're going to get to Overview, after the ban 2002 to 2008. So we only got one more section left. In 2002, the first free elections were held in Kenya's history, with the result that the Kenyan African National Union, the KANU, was finally removed from office. Those were the guys that were helping the Mungiki. Okay. Almost immediately, a ban on the Mungiki was issued by the new government. See, I was trying to say, that's why it's kind of a little confusing in the beginning.
Yeah.
This is where we clear it up. As well as an investigation into the loan of the military automobiles. For the first time, the Mungiki became a real concern at a national level and not just a concern for local authorities. Gradually, resistance to the Mungiki grew, both on the part of local organizations representing communities dominated by the Mungiki racketeering operations, but also on the part of police and security forces attempting to enforce the ban. Mm. So they're banning these guys.
Oh, man.
So that's why the police are attacking them like fucking like Bloods and Crips or like, you know, Norteños and Sereños. It's like if you see these guys, it's fucking on.
Mm.
A pattern of attacks and reprisal began with the first instances of police assassinations and kidnappings, as well as extreme violence in Kenya's streets related to the Mungiki. They control the fucking poor people. They're going to go buck wild in there. Though the ban was ineffective in destroying the Mungiki, it was enough to limit the control of the organization on its previous monopolies. Throughout 2007, in an effort to regain control of the taxi business as well as influence that year's national elections, the Mungiki embarked on a campaign marked by what would become known as the Mungiki's new hallmark trait of attacking people, which is beheadings.
Yeah.
These guys get real psycho here, and we're going to go a little depth into it later. The death of a 12-year-old boy who was part of a child sacrifice ritual and the murder of two Americans brought further attention to the group, as did several massacres and street battles fought during the election season. The 2007 election, marred by violence and insecurity due to political infighting, saw the peak of attention towards the Mungiki, who were widely credited for exacerbating the political violence of 2007 that saw more than 1,000 people killed and over 600,000 displaced from their homes.
Wow.
Though banned, the Mungiki reached something of a peak of their influence, with members being consulted by the government as local defense during the riots of 2007.
Can I say this?
Huh.
You read really well while drinking.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, man. Like, I'm impressed. You've been killing beers and just reading perfectly. You started once.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, man.
Well, you know what it is, man? I feel in comedy for me, too, if I can get two and a half beers into me, two beers in a shot, that's my...
That's your nice...
I'm working up.
Okay.
I'm working at that. I'm not in my head. I'm not anything. Things are smooth. I can even slur when I'm fucking talking like normal English. You know what I mean?
I'm like 3/4 of a way through a beer, and I'm like, oh man. I'm just like, ooh.
It's hard to even read. Right. Yeah. I'm reading drunk.
Yeah, I got my glasses on. I can't really see that word.
All right, we're at the last part before we get into some deep death or death too, but deep in depth of what
this is a part of the episode where we hit that wah 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 wah
do do and just see these guys like. All right, March 5th, 2009, due to their prominence in the Kikuyu community, meetings are allegedly held with the Mungiki about post-election security. The government is accused of giving over some security authority to the gangs in response to anti-Kikuyu violence. So like I said, or like, you know, this is a little confusing, but so these guys became in power because they were trying to protect their community of the Kikuyu against the Maasai and the other guys, because they're only 17% of the population. Mm-hmm. So they do need to exist,
right?
Because of the hate that's happening to them. But March 5th, 2009, that Oscar Kingara is now assassinated in Nairobi, the guy who made the papers of how these guys are getting fucked up by cops, is assassinated. We'll learn how he's assassinated. And what happens is this guy's shit doesn't even get released. It gets released via WikiLeaks. And then people...
His assassination?
The paper he wrote.
Okay.
Remember how I was talking about, like, these guys have, like, people that do these in-depth research things, and it kind of...
Yeah, in the beginning.
And it really changes how the world is seen and all this stuff, like, or their world is seen. This guy did this in-depth thing of, like, hey, these guys are psychopaths. I mean, he was kind of on the McGeeky side, but he's like, these guys are crazy, but what the police are doing them is, you know, swiping them up off the streets, beating, torturing, cutting off their limbs, doing crazy shit. Now he's killed like 2 years later in Nairobi at the University of Nairobi because he's a fucking professor there. His published and unpublished reports circulate widely on WikiLeaks. The killers are not found, but investigations cast suspicion on police tactical units. And we say tactical units, when we read about this later, you'll know why. Essentially, it was like a fucking SWAT hit. These guys driving with his assistant in front of the campus. We're on the fucking campus right now, ASU.
Yeah.
Truck pulls in front of him. The guy slams on his brake. He tries to back up. Truck pulls behind him. Truck pulls to the side. Opens the thing. Two guys in automatic pistols.
No way.
They all pull away.
That's like a scene out of a movie.
Yeah. And that's what they did, these guys.
Oh, man.
October of 2009. Oh, actually, why is that? That's messed up. March should have gone later. October 2009, senior Mungiki leader Mayana Nzinga is acquitted of murder. Days later, his spokesman is shot and killed. So these police are tightening their grips on these guys. November 2009, senior members of the Kenyan National Youth League, the youth wing of the Mungiki, are shot in Nairobi. Mm. Right here, overview. Make that what we just talked about a little more digestible for ya. 2008 to the present. In the aftermath of the 2000 elections, with major reforms to both the executive and judicial branches of the Kenyan government, the security forces and police embark on an expansive campaign to purge the banned Mungiki cult from public life. Mm. So, I feel like if you don't do child sacrifices, you might still be able to be a religion. But once your child sacrifice is coming in there, you get to cult real fast. Well, it begins as raids by elite flying squads of Kenyan police escalated into assassinations, kidnappings, and torture of confirmed and suspected Mungiki members and their associates. Due to the ethnic nature of the Mungiki as the Kikuyu organization, there is also intense and intra-ethnic violence in members of the organization being attacked by those whom they taxed and extorted. So now everyone's mad at them. So now these guys are getting less and less more people. The people that they're making charge for the bathroom, the taxi guys that they were charging, are now starting to attack back at them.
Mm.
Police violence peak in 2008 and 2009 when thousands of Mungiki members are being shot, tortured, or simply disappear while in police custody.
Whoa.
Thousands.
Whoa. While in custody.
Just in custody. So just getting scooped up and getting disappeared. Thousands in 2 years. So that's like 4 or 5 a day. Investigations into the security forces have led to the accusations that the police not only target the Mungiki, but journalists and civil rights representatives that investigate extrajudicial activities. Like the guy who made that paper. Through the Kenyan government has come under intense scrutiny for these activities, the Mungiki have been further driven underground, where their secretive practices are even less in the public eyes. With a prescription against revealing Mungiki secrets or even leaving the organization, many members have fled Kenya both to escape the police as well as their Mungiki brethren. So now we're going to go into some of their crazy cases that we talked about, 2007,
okay.
The local vigilantes. We got about 4 of these and then we're done.
Nice. This is crazy. I got to say, like, this has just been heightening. It's like at every stop of the way, you're like, this is bad. Then it gets more bad. It's like, when does it stop?
You know what's and it's as bad as they get, but it starts when someone comes into your fucking country and destabilizes the government and tries to take over and take money off your shit, and then when they leave abruptly, have nothing to do. It's like I'll let you go in 1 second and say something, yeah. So keep it in your mind. But it's a lot like when you had that bad kid in school who dealt drugs and beat up kids. You're like, what happened to you? Then you go home and his whole house is destabilized. His parents aren't there. He has to live on his own. It's hard to go right from there when you don't know what's wrong.
Yeah. It just made me think of like the difference between Western and Eastern medicine. It's like Eastern medicine is encouraged that you take this precaution of like healthy living and you eat healthy and you do this kind of thing, where Western medicine is like, one thing goes bad, you do this to protect that or get rid of this, and then that springs into existence another ailment or another problem, and then you bring this to take care of that and brings another thing. So it's like, that's gnarly.
Yeah, that
where does it end?
It's exactly what they did, right? Something went bad, so then the Kikuyu, the guys who are a small percentage, 17% of Kenya,
the medicine,
the medicine is the Mungiki. They're like, the Kikuyu are getting killed and raped and whatever. So they're like, we'll create our own private military to help protect us. And then they keep, then they come into that, but then they take over the taxis.
And in theory, that's supposed to work, right?
Yes.
It's like, this is going to work. But you fail to look, you fail to have the forward thinking to be like, what other problems could come from this? And it just doesn't end until it's not a problem no more and everything has been essentially eradicated.
And then that's what these guys do. They go, okay, we're going to eradicate these fucking Mingiki. One, because we're kind of racist against the Kikuyu. Two, because the Mingiki have been going buck fucking wild for 20 years and doing wild shit and charging us for pooping and not letting me leave my city. And then it goes ruckus. So we did the...
Don't they still technically charge to go to the restroom?
There? Probably.
No. Here in the U.S., you go to like a Burger King, you got to put a quarter in the thing and then turn the knob.
Yeah, and where do you don't do that at In-N-Out. You don't do that at a Carl's Jr. somewhere. You do that at a Burger King in the middle of the fucking hood.
Now, yeah, that's so true. Like they don't charge for that in a quote unquote nice neighborhood. They do that. You know, it's like.
I mean, that also could be because like heroin addicts are going in there and shooting blood all over. I was in San Francisco for a little while in downtown L.A. And
you're like, I thought you were about to say I did do heroin for a little bit.
I never did heroin.
Whoa,
not yet. Still got
not
time.
Yet. You're still young.
So we're going to do a quick overview of the 2008 to the present, and then we're going to get into some of their crimes.
Okay.
And the crimes get a little more juicy.
Ooh.
Crackdown.
Go grab a beer, guys.
Grab me one, too, in the fridge. Okay, so we're going to go into the Mingiki attacks against Winman, the social aspects of the Mingiki, October of 2000, the 24th. Though a criminal enterprise, the Mingiki has been compared to the Cosa Nostra, the Mexican Mafia, and the Yakuza, not only for their criminal activity, but also to the deep social and cultural aspects of the organization. Wow, what a great sentence right there. Because you talk about Italians, they relate heavily to the Cosa Nostra. You're Mexican, maybe you might know some people in the Mexican Mafia. They have probably a hold over a lot of things in maybe Mexican neighborhoods. The Yakuza in Japan are in the culture. Like, these things are in the culture of places. Though they were founded in the late 1980s or the early 90s, by 2000 they had boasted thousands of members and advocated for radical changes in Kenyan society. As self-appointed heirs to the Mau Mau, the Mingiki claimed a violent, anti-capitalist, and anti-Western view of the world, advocating for Kenya to be remade as a more traditional society. Over the weekend of October 20th to the 22nd, 2000, the Mingiki engaged in a rampage of attacks against women, one of their first high-profile crimes that publicly showed them to mobilize against their perceived cultural and societal enemies. Mm. Prior to being banned in 2002, the Mingiki were free to associate with people that's also another thing. When they got banned, so the police started eradicating them, and they also weren't allowed to hang out with each other. You know, kind of like gangs in LA or gangs in America. If you have like a, what is it? If you get gang affiliated or whether, you're not allowed to gather with like another guy.
More
who's
than
gang
three?
Yeah,
people.
More than three people. So
yeah.
During a gathering in the town of Cayole, an anti-Western demonstration spiraled out of control. Overpowering police that had been assigned to watch their public demonstration, the Mingiki attacked local women, stripping them naked and beating them. In the most notorious cases, women wearing trousers, pants, which are traditionally Western, were stripped naked and then whipped for hours. Oh, ostensibly, this was due to prescriptions against women wearing clothing, and what was the first of many of the women attacked were assaulted by actual female members of the organization. So it was like women were doing it. By the time that the riot was brought under control, they had targeted other Western groups such as Freemasons and churches. The public nature of these attacks and its explicit targeting of Western culture helped bring the Mingiki to the public sphere, but also served as a turning point against the Mingiki. Before this, they were kind of like, you know, guys, I just wanted to restore, get rid of Westerners, get rid of this shit that's gone into their culture. But now they took a thing of, they went fucking crazy with it. While it did not affect their standing as a criminal organization, they were seen less as traditionalists and nationalists, what I was saying, and more as extremists, isolating themselves from a wider public, more than their campaign of bus taxiing and hijacking in the years since their founding. So this was the one where they kind of lost any support. Central Providence Massacre, turning point against the Mingiki, December 2007. So this was that.
This is a catalyst right here.
Yeah, this is the one that everything turns, and this is in that 2007 year that we talked about that was fucked up.
What were you doing in 2007?
I graduated high school.
Oh, wow.
You were what? You were in college?
Yeah, I was in college. I graduated 04.
Yeah. So it was a good year for me. I had a great year, 2007, actually. Not can't say the same for the people of Kenya. Though the group was banned in 2002 following the death of their political allies in the Kenyan National Union, the KANU, the immediate police response was, though often violent, rather limited. A full-fledged crackdown had not occurred, but in the wake of the violence of 2007, the Mungiki became targets of police violence. So, like we were saying before, you know, that guy published this paper that these guys are getting targeted, but
we're... The professor guy.
Well, we're going to learn why they were being fucking targeted, because they went psycho. Throughout the year of 2007, the Mungiki attempt to regain their prominent role in Kenyan society by influence the outcome of 2007, an attempt to overturn the 2002 election that had banned them. Throughout the spring and summer, a wave of beheadings occurred against their political enemies, and beheadings became a hallmark of the group. It's not a thing you normally want of a hallmark of a group. You normally want Christmas movies, maybe chocolates, but not...
Nice things.
I wish the Hallmark Network had a lot more movies with beheadings in them. In July of 2007, a 12-year-old boy was beheaded in what was described as a ritual killing, a child sacrifice tied to the Mungiki's interpretation of both Islam and traditional African folk religion.
Why'd they do that? They just, that was just a thing?
I don't know. I mean, maybe drugs were involved. I don't know. You know, like I tried
what
to find out.
It's like, what kind of headspace are you in where you're like, this
chopping
is good.
A child's head off.
Jesus,
and
man.
People are like, yeah, fucking yeah, chop that kid's head off.
Not cool, bro.
In September, when two Americans were killed, the Mungiki reached an American audience. You don't want to do that. With more details of their mysterious religion was made public, including allegations of cannibalism. They started eating people at this time, too. On December 8th, men were beheaded publicly, and then their bodies and heads were impaled on spikes. The notoriety of the Mungiki reached its highest point. In the chaos of the 2007 elections held later that month, both the police and the Mungiki barked on a campaign of violence. While the Mungiki failed to influence the elections and returned largely to their efforts to control the taxi business, extrajudicial police efforts and local vigilanteism began to push the Mungiki out of the mainstream and drive them underground. In 2008, it would be the police that would be accused of the worst violence as they attempt to eradicate the banned Mungiki. So also... This is, you know, you called it, this is the turning point, local vigilanteism. So now everyone's mad. You got guys on the street that are like...
Everyone's going to do their part to restore peace, and it's like, that's going to clash.
It's exactly what happened when the Kenyans came up and fought the fucking British out, you know? And it showed, not a backbone to say that if, when you don't do this, a backbone, but to show that you're willing to risk everything.
Yeah.
And that's how far they got pushed, that just normal people had to push back. And these guys now aren't seen as nationalist guys that are want us to bring back. They're seen as criminals, cannibalists, and fucking child murderers. Mm. The Mathira Massacre. The Mungiki retaliate against local vigilantes. April 21st, 2009. One day after 420. The Kiri Ngari, I think I actually said that pretty good, district in the heart of the country in the site of Mount Kenya is atypical of Kenya. Rich in natural resources, beauty, heavily reliant on agricultural, and riven by ethnic and political divisions. Though the majority of the people live in rural areas and are engaged in agriculture, like much of Kenya, regions where towns, rural environments meet are often the center of ethnic and political violence. In the early weeks of 2009, Kiringara district saw an uptick in random violence perpetrated by members of the Mungiki. Several Mungiki members had been killed in unknown circumstances, with the Mungiki in turn attacking the suspected vigilantes that attacked them. With control of the taxis and bus business, a central platform of Mungiki criminal activity, it was natural that they would strike at rival cabbies and bus services.
So think about this. It's like if they're controlling the logistics of the town that they're controlling, they basically have control of the whole place. They can't have
anyone move.
Logistically, no one's moving. They know exactly where everyone is, and they, yeah.
Yeah, like, I kept saying the taxi thing over and over again, but the whole time it was taxis and buses.
Yeah, so, like, essentially, just, yeah, the logistics of a town, like, think of the metro system of any big city. If they control that, no one's moving around. Anyone, like, and who's moving around? It's people with not a lot of resources, because if you have resources, you would have your own transportation, which in these times...
they don't
not
have
happening.
Yeah, this, I mean, this is fucking 10 years ago. They don't have that. And also, it's like your blood. Imagine your blood standing still. A place needs everyone to move around and do all this stuff. And what's the thing that controls your blood? Your heart.
Which, so, philosophically, if we go into like a Bruce Lee quote, it's like, I remember him talking about like water needs to move,
mm-hmm.
right? In order for it to be like alive. The moment water stops moving, what happens to it? It rots. So in a city, when you have people not moving around or going about, you know, freely, it's like the society tends to kind of go in a downward spiral.
Excellent. That was an excellent point. By mid-April, the shadow government of the Mangiki, which collected extortion money and racketeering operations, was being resisted by locals who refused to pay taxes. Vigilante mobs were turned against the Mangiki and openly fought them in the streets with machetes and stones. During a funeral for one of their members, a group of the Mangiki were confronted by local hostiles. In what was later described as an ambush, other Mangiki members crept through their bushes around the rival towns and people and attacked them with axes, machetes, and rocks. The fighting lasted for several hours, after which 27 people were left dead. 37 were later arrested, but they're released for lack of evidence. Why? Because they killed the whole fucking town. So who's going to say that these guys did anything wrong? It's not like they have cameras up.
Yeah.
It was reported that a lot of the police and local enforcement were bribed. As of yet, no one had been prosecuted. Actually, you know what? I said that wrong. That was the locals that killed a bunch of Mangiki.
You said hostile locals.
Yeah. So the hostile locals went to the funeral, surrounded the Mangiki, and killed 27 of them. But since the police hated the Mangiki and the law enforcement hated the Mangiki, all 37 got off. Though hardly the worst violence
Because when you said hostiles for a second, my after one beer brain thought you meant like hostels, like people were traveling.
Just a bunch of French kids.
Yeah, I was like, oh, they're getting involved.
So that was a murder thing. We got one more, and then we're done here. And this is the one at the assassination thing.
Brace yourself, you guys. Take a smoke break or a potty break. It's about to go down.
Yeah, this is the guy. This is the last one. This is the Oscar Kingara, the guy who tried to stick up for the Mangiki.
Oh.
Yeah. The upending of the 50-year one-party regime in 2002 was quickly followed by a widespread coordination response against the Mangiki, who had supported the ousted Kenyan African National Union Party. Apart from being banned, widespread latitude was given to the police to pursue the Mangiki. We talked about that. Okay, here we go. Last part. Oscar Kingara, a middle-class Kenyan lawyer, was employed in his family's industrial enterprises in Nairobi, but utilized his free time and money to create the Oscar Legal Aid Foundation. Among their chief purposes was the investigation of the police, widely seen as operating a vigilante campaign against the Mangiki. With cooperation from WikiLeaks, he documented more than 8,000 cases of police murder and torture.
8,000.
8,000. And that's that what we said, 2007 to 2009.
So he essentially created a his own watchdog kind of situation.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the investigation would culminate in the paper called The Cry of Blood, published locally and internationally, mainly through WikiLeaks, because the local guys...
Cry of Blood, that's the name of the newspaper, you guys.
that's the heading. You know it's going to start pretty good after that.
Oof.
The success of the paper brought new light on the police campaign against the Mangiki, the new prominence of Kingara and his staff. Following the report, the United Nations appointed a special representative on the subject of extrajudicial police killings, which urged the investigation of and firing of senior members of the Ministry of Justice. But guess what? That doesn't happen. On March 5th, 2009, Kingara and his aide, John Paul Uwalu, were parked in traffic in front of the University of Nairobi, where they had been working on papers to be presented to the parliament on the matter of police assassinations and disappearances. A van cut in front of them, with a second one blocking the rear. Two men left the van, approached their car, firing semi-automatic pistols into both windows. The two men, wearing suits, they also stole a nearby guy who saw them, and they killed just as random.
Whoa. Yeah, that's like a Hollywood movie scene right there.
Oof. So this is the interesting part, and to show how much these Mangiki are hated and how much the government didn't like him. The killings were nationally and internationally blamed on the police services. International aid in the investigation of the murders, including the intervention of the FBI, was denied by the government, who have yet to investigate the murders or even care. The murder of King Gar remains one of the most infamous episodes in the police campaign against the Mangeki.
Wow. So the powers to be say, FBI, chill.
Yeah, we don't give a fuck.
Wow.
It's like if your parent, like someone was like, hey, your kid has been going around beating up all my kids. And you're like, yeah, I don't care. Doesn't matter.
What do you do at that point? There's nothing you can do. That's like, you know, the old saying of like throwing ice cubes at the devil is like, what can you possibly affect in this situation?
I mean, yeah, you're not going to get in trouble. The guys who wanted these police to kill these guys are not going to then get them in trouble because they have no one to get them in trouble. And it started from a good place of these guys wanting to be nationalists. It went to them being crazy. Then the police started in a good place, you know, just like the medicine thing of wanting to control these guys who have been crazy.
It starts in a good place, but focus is lost. And sometimes there's things that you don't think through, and then that becomes a bigger problem. And, you know, now you're chasing the fires and, you know, you can't put them all out at one time.
Well, thanks for doing the podcast, buddy.
Dude, thank you for having me. This
appreciate
is so gnarly.
It.
Thank you so much,
man. That was fun. Make sure you guys keep listening. Thanks for listening. I'll do all the credits and all the other cool stuff. You have anything you want to say?
No, keep listening. This is great. I learned a lot. This is something I wouldn't have researched on my own. So thank you for inviting me. This was really fun. And
we're going to be together in San Diego in the next week or two.
Yes.
So
San Diego, June, right?
June.
First week of June. Check us out. We're going to be down there.
American Comic
bringing the funnies.
Check that out if you guys like it. Thanks for checking us out. I'll do the little intro later. Bye.